executive chair of the World Energy Trilemma, the World Energy Council. Gerwin, come and take a seat. And Henry Edwards Evans, associate editorial director at Platts Power in Europe. Henry. Tom Greatrex, MP, the Labour Shadow Energy Minister. I think he's still on his way, so we'll get him to join us when he does. We'll start without him. Joe, why don't you kick off proceedings and give us a brief intro on to how broke is our energy market and how do we fix it?
Thank you very much, Andrew. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thanks to the Spectator for allowing me the opportunity to contribute to what's already been a fascinating debate. Since I was asked to participate, I noticed the question has changed from is the UK system broken to how broken is it? And I think that's a fair reflection of the discussion we've just been having. World Energy Trilemma looks at countries' energy policies against the three goals, and you'll be astonished to hear that the UK is one of only three out of 129 that gets a AAA rating, i.e. in the top 25 for all three. But the truth is, it's on negative watch, and it's on negative watch because its performance is on quite a significant downward trend on both security and affordability. But clearly, with the discussion we've had about capacity, security, and everything else, we all know that. I think that the things that we've heard today that bother me are that actually people seem to feel reasonably confident about this winter and possibly next, that nothing new is getting built yet. And it's going to take more than 2 years to come on stream. And even next year, I think views are divided about how comfortable we should be in the electricity market. And by the way, I am going to concentrate on electricity. I'd like to pose the gas conundrum. How can we expect people to be building gas-fired power generation when from 2020 onwards, the mix of targets for low carbon generation, namely renewables and at some point during that decade nuclear, for energy efficiency, which will flatten demand, means that actually we won't really need additional gas. So quite apart from the fact of whether
the microphone just a little away from your mouth, it's distorted, thank you.
Quite apart from the fact that the investment is challenged by the current framework. What is the long-term future for it, even if government got the framework right? And the framework is challenging because of the things we've heard about priority for renewables, setting very low marginal prices, competition from coal with no real deterrent effect from the carbon price, and utility balance sheets are under significant pressure by a combination of the policies and flat demand. So I think we do have a conundrum there, which is whether we can create the framework in which that investment will come forward. That assumes that we do need extra capacity, and I think from what we've heard today, we do. So that's energy security. I won't go into gas markets because I think there's no reason to worry about the volumes of gas that are available, and I don't think, frankly, over the next several years that prices seem to be a major concern in the gas market. But what about prices and competitiveness? Within the EU, it depends how you measure it, different prices for different customers. But I think there's no real reason to believe the UK is far out from the centre. For the EU as a whole, we're higher than our competitors, and we have been for some very considerable time. I mean, we've historically been 1.5 times higher than the US, and we're now about double and set to remain so. But by the way, China's electricity prices won't be very different. They'll be about double the US. Japan, currently about three times. could come down to about double, provided they get their nuclear power stations back on. So I'm not sure that the impact of taxes and levies should have the prominence in the debate that it does, because they're relatively short-term, historically speaking. But clearly they're creating pain for some particular industries, and I'll come back to that in a minute. Should we abandon our low-carbon targets because of the impact on competitiveness, even if, as I would argue, it's not perhaps as great as some fear? Well, John Hutton mentioned the international obligations, which is one impediment to doing so. And on that, I think the real solution to carbon leakage is about a binding global agreement. We do a survey annually of what keeps energy CEOs awake at night, and the highest issue in terms of its uncertainty, the critical uncertainty, is the lack of a global climate framework. Some silver linings in the cloud at the moment: the US-China deal and great hopes for Paris in December 2015. So I would suggest that actually we shouldn't be abandoning the low carbon targets, but we need to manage our approach to that issue much, much more effectively. The first thing is to get much more long term and coherent about how we do it. And in relation to the politicisation, we had a discussion earlier around whether you could take that political risk away from politicians, and clearly it's right that you can't. That's where the buck stops. But maybe there are some changes that could be made that would help the politicians not to be quite so short-term with one another. And one of them, I would suggest, is actually to follow the example of some countries who put delivery at arm's length from government. So that helps to depoliticise to some extent. It also gives you a source of independent advice. The second thing is that obviously you've got to go for a more cost-effective approach than we have and than some of our neighbours in the EU have. And it has to be effective as well as cost-effective. Andrew mentioned Germany and the fact that they're paying a huge amount in subsidies. If they stopped any new subsidies now, still facing a bill of 200 billion euros, and yet their CO2 emissions have gone up. So clearly that approach of advancing renewables as an end in itself, rather than looking at the various means that you could adopt and the pace at which you could adopt them, needs to be reconsidered. For renewables in particular, we're going to have them, we're going to need to get them to market viability, but we should be doing that so far as possible, taking into account their huge capital intensity and thinking about how we replace stuff coming off the system with renewables. And Angela mentioned that in her intervention about looking at what's coming off as well as what's being built. Just to turn finally to the UK, I do think we've got to be realistic about where our comparative advantage does and does not lie. And if you don't do that, then actually you're going to get into trouble. But that doesn't mean that you can ignore the impacts on your energy intensive industries. And so you need to be very careful about what kind of transitional solutions you put in place in terms of perhaps recycling some of the proceeds from carbon pricing and so forth. But if you don't do anything to help people change their model, you risk falling into what I call the Detroit trap. And there you had the car industry successfully lobbying against efficiency standards, and we all know what happened there. In relation to the UK, got to address this gas conundrum. And we've got to do so within the context of this whole system question that somebody raised at the end of the last session. And we need to be much more coherent about looking at the interactions with things like heat and transport. And again, that came up. Second, We've got to reform the emissions trading scheme in a way that is durable and gives us an effective carbon price, which doesn't mean it's completely predictable, but it does mean that industry can make judgments about it like any other commodity. And finally, I'd like to pick up a point that somebody made earlier, the need for more honest conversations with the public. We really need to get away from the myth that somehow there is cheap energy that is risk-free, that doesn't involve any building of any infrastructure on any scenic landscape, and we are facing some very hard choices. Thank you very much.
John McNaughton, thank you very much.
Let's hear now from Henry Edwards Evans. Do we know if Tom Braytrack's MP is actually
arrived?
He's
just arrived.
Oh, he has arrived, excellent. Okay, well, let's put him up onto the platform when he gets here.
Good, Henry. So I can be a warm-up act for you.
Yeah, exactly.
And the challenge is to say something that hasn't already been said today. So I will keep it short and sweet and to the point. Patrick earlier said that he was a price reporter back in the 70s. I'm from Platts and I'm a price reporter today, or I work with them anyway. And so let's look at UK market liquidity in the wholesale market. And I think this is a problem. So if we're looking at potential broken energy market, then you could look at the liquidity in the UK market. In day ahead, the liquidity is good. Front month is quite good. Front season is quite good. But when we look beyond there, then we see liquidity draining away. And the problem that people that I talk to refer to is the Hinkley contract, and the fact that the Hinkley contract will be based on a curve price reference. And if there's no confidence in that curve price reference, if there's a lack of trust in that number, then that really undermines the whole underpinning basis of the contract. So not only have we heard that people think that the contract strike price is very high, actually people are worried that the way that the strike price works, where you take away the wholesale price, that element could be open to some kind of market manipulation if that part of the market is very illiquid. Okay, so let's have a look at the price as of today. Day ahead averaged £47 in November in the UK. If I look at that in euro terms, that's €60 a megawatt hour. Now that is very high if we look across Europe. Germany is more like 38, 37 euros a megawatt hour. Even a tight market like Belgium is well below the UK day-ahead price. So we're looking at a high price, but then if we're looking at bringing new investment into the market, the levelized cost of electricity is, as we've heard, around £80 a megawatt hour at least. So all technologies, not just gas, not just onshore wind, not just solar, not the more competitive ones now. All technologies are much more expensive than the energy-only price in the market. Nothing is being drawn in at present. So in that sense, yes, the UK market is not working. What are the solutions? Ofgem has proposed and put forward and now implemented Secure and Promote, whereby the big six have to bid into these windows in future on the curve a certain amount of electricity during 2 1-hour windows during the day. Now, it's too early to say whether this is working, whether new entrants are coming in and taking up that power and improving liquidity further out on the curve. But early indications are that the new entrants aren't that happy with it. What they always argued for was a self-supply restriction on the big six, so that they couldn't keep that power internally for their own needs, that they would have to market it in the open market. That would boost liquidity, that would go some way to solve the problem of lack of confidence in the forward curve. Other problems. Okay, so Labour are proposing to freeze end user tariffs and to potentially split up the big six. That might also improve liquidity along the curve. Then you've got the capacity mechanism. The capacity mechanism is going to support a lot of existing plant in the first auction next month. but it remains to be seen how much new plant will be brought in the next year or two. I think once the cost of the capacity mechanism becomes clear, then I think we will be drawn back into this political arena whereby newspapers and commentators like myself get onto the fact that this, even if it clears at about £35 a kilowatt, it's going to cost about £1.7 billion a year, which sounds like quite a big figure to be shoving at existing coal plant, existing gas plant, and bringing on maybe only a very small amount of new gas plant. So I'm just flagging that up as a potential problem in the next 6 months or so, once we get the results of the first auction. As a footnote, and to finish, we've been talking about wholesale prices, but actually for voters, it's end user bills that's the key. So while our wholesale price in the UK is relatively high compared to European prices, actually our end user bills are below the EU 15 average. So if we look at the Berlin price, they're paying 30 euro cents a kilowatt hour, while in London, we're paying 20 euro cents a kilowatt hour. So freezing those tariffs actually isn't potentially getting to the another the problem, which is that we've got very expensive end user bills, because actually we don't. Thank you very much.
Henry, thank you very much for that.
And our final speaker in this panel, he's our final speaker for the day, to give us his quick view on this issue of is the British energy market broken? How should it be fixed? Please welcome the Labour Shadow Minister for Energy, Tom Greatrex.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed, Andrew, and apologies for being a little late. So I got most of, well, part of what Henry was saying, just on one point, just on his final point about end user bills, because I think this is important. It depends on how you define what the end user cost is, because in the UK we apply much less tax than other EU countries do. So the end user bill in terms of the bill that consumers pay for their household bills is actually is not amongst those in the EU 15, even though the cost may, you know, you can define the cost of that. So the end user bill what people actually pay isn't the lowest, because we apply less tax to 5% than it's much higher in other EU states, which sometimes distorts that picture. The question was whether the energy market is broken and what should be done to fix it. My view, Labour's view, is that there are problems with the way in which the energy market is currently structured. They have come to the fore in the last couple of years because of effectively a perfect storm of factors, issues where people's incomes are being squeezed and the costs and the bills are going up. When we have had a situation over that period where there's been more attention, therefore, on what people are paying in their bills, where we've had a period of time where a number of the big suppliers have been involved in various different things and different activity, which is they've now come to say that they regret doing, whether that's on aspects of doorstep selling, and some of the issues around their customer service, all these issues which might seem very minor or very consumer end of this business are important, because they feed into a sense of dissatisfaction, a lack of confidence, and a lack of trust, which is at the root of the issues around the way in which the market doesn't work. And where I think there needs to be change is, because this isn't, apart from for a very, very few people, a discretionary product. Nearly every single household needs energy, and I can't think of very many, if there are any, businesses or people involved in economic activity that don't need energy some way along the track. So you can't, it's not like a consumer good you can opt out of. It's something you need, something you'll need to effectively to live your life. And so therefore I think we need to look at it slightly differently than a traditional market for a consumer product. And that's why the issues around transparency in the market are key. Now, 2 years ago when the Energy Act was going through Parliament, at that time, myself and my colleagues argued that there should be some changes and reforms to the retail and wholesale market, including, and again, just touching on the point that Henry was making around self-supply restriction, and a way of doing that is by ensuring and making mandatory that power is traded through an open exchange, not necessarily having to reinvent a pool, but potentially using the existing exchanges that are in place, and that there needs to be much greater transparency between the retail and generation arms of the large vertically integrated suppliers. That's an issue which will have an impact in terms of liquidity, and also is something which some of the smaller suppliers who, despite what sometimes you hear people say, most of them did exist before 2010, but their increase in terms of their proportion of the market has increased in the last year and a bit, particularly as people have become more aware of some of these issues, and they've been, and some of them have been very adept at identifying and making their offer to what is quite often a dissatisfied consumer group, or at least the engagement of it is pretty dissatisfied, although we should remember that very many people still do not ever switch from their supplier. And if you look at the figures of the number of people who are with their electricity supplier as the one that they inherited their geographical area from post-privatisation, you'll see that in, I think, every single region, the majority of customers are still with what was their previous geographical supplier. I think there's only one reason, one region where that isn't the case. So issues around ensuring that there's proper transparency between the retail and generation. I mean, indeed, SSE have announced last year that they are earlier this year, they're in the process of starting to move in that direction. We know that that's one of the focus of the work that the CMA is currently undertaking. The EOM announcement today, whilst not completely in that direction, is quite interesting in terms of how they seek to separate their fossil fuel generation and some of their European assets from both their retail and renewable generation parts of their business, and also the way in which they seem to be, from their announcement, making much more of a focus on the demand side management and various different techniques and technologies, because that's where they see their possibilities for growing their business into the future. And I think that level of transparency is absolutely important if we're going to have a situation where we can get to where all the big companies say to their customers they want to be. They've all launched in slightly different language various different initiatives, whether it's resetting their relationship, whether it's about the trust agenda. They're all basically doing similar things, which is to demonstrate that actually as companies they provide significant amount of value. And I would never argue with the fact that they are significant employers in the UK, and whilst there have been some who have been perhaps less have used different techniques, that many of them pay tax, and that they are also important in terms of some of the investment we need. Although, as I think Andrew, last time we discussed these issues, we had a discussion about the amount of investment that's coming from out with the Big Six and how that's increasing as a proportion. But until we get an energy market where people have more confidence in it, you're not going to get that relationship rebuilt, and you're not going to have a proper discussion about why we pay what we pay. We shouldn't underestimate the scale of the challenge. I'm sure that's what you've been discussing in various different aspects, from different forms of unconventional gas to nuclear to everything else during the course of the day so far. But to properly address that, we need to have a market that's open and fair and transparent. And the package of reforms that Labour's suggesting, which sit underneath the price freeze that gets the attention, are key to ensuring that transparency and clarity is there in the market, which we need for the future if we're going to ever have, if we're going to have a chance of meeting the various commitments that we have, both those enshrined in legislation and those which are vital for, whilst not necessarily being in legislation, for ensuring that we keep the lights on and have a secure energy supply for the future.
Tom, thank you very much.
Tom, thanks for that. John, if I could just come back to you, just to get this clear in my mind, when you look at various sophisticated energy markets, how does Britain's compare?
I think we historically have done very well in terms of the benefits that liberalising our energy markets brought us. We were one of the pathfinders on that, and it's interesting that the current market opening in Europe actually follows very much the British model. So I would think overall we probably compare quite well. I think the fly in the ointment really is the complexity and scale of the changes being made over a very short period to what is a complex system, the electricity market system.
Tom, let's look at this issue of vertical integration of the big six. Because it's always a hard thing to regulate, because it involves transparency, and it involves transfer pricing and internal pricing. Very, regulators can do, but it's very hard to know exactly what the situation is. I mean, we've seen that in different ways with Google and Amazon and so on, just charging massive fees for their intellectual property rights, then banking the profits, courtesy of Mr. Juncker in Luxembourg. Just as well, he's not the European Commission president. Oh, he is, sorry, got that wrong. Wouldn't it be simpler just to break them up? Wouldn't it be cleaner to say, right, you're an electricity generation, what you generate goes into a pool, and those who then want to sell it on to the end user will bid for that pool of electricity?
Well, you can achieve the beneficial aspects of what you're describing, I think, by having an effective ring fence between the two parts of the business, in the same way that there is a legal ring fence in between for those which are SSE and Scottish Power, those who still have networks business in the UK and their other business. So Scottish Power, you know, their networks business is happens to be located in my constituency in the office building that it's in. It's on one floor. Their generation business is on a different floor. They are part of the same group, but there are very strict rules about the way in which they interact, and sometimes you hear one part of it being quite frustrated with the other part of it because of the strict adherence to those rules. I think that's the best way of being able to do that. Now, you may find, I mean, E.ON's announcement last night into this morning is quite interesting in the way in which some of those companies may wish to go. And the received wisdom previously, when we were talking about this a year or more ago, was, well, who would want to have the customer bit of the business? But it's interesting from the E.ON announcement that it seems to be they seem to think that their future is more in the customer side of the business, both business and residential. And I think that's that'll be an interesting way in which they may wish to go down that route themselves. But I don't think we should necessarily force them to do that, as long as the transparency is there and the differentiation between the two parts of the business is clear.
Harry, what do you think of that? I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is that we're talking about the kind of Chinese walls that investment banks were supposed to have.
Yeah, I mean, to drag you back to the first question, first of all, it's really hard to compare one electricity system with another. So essentially the UK is an island system with a couple of interconnectors. I think one thing that everybody will agree on is that the more interconnectors we can get, the more we can develop our market along the lines that we'd like to, in terms of trying to get some of these building blocks in place that are seen in the internal energy market. And that means moving away from renewable subsidies over time, so that the whole system's a lot more efficient, so that we can use the cheapest kilowatt hour when it's available. At the moment we can't. We need to align timings of the markets so that all the players can play together on the same playing field. We need to improve the intraday market so that we can get really close to the point of delivery in a competitive market, so that you can get down to 15-minute trading instead of day-ahead trading. And that will help you to assimilate renewables. But at the same time, you need to require renewables to be balance responsible. This was mentioned earlier on.
What does that mean?
This was mentioned earlier on. The idea that you link a wind farm to a pump storage project. Okay, well, the most efficient way of doing that actually is just to make sure that they have to balance their position. It's the same proposition, but you do that by opening up various short-term balancing markets, and you require the renewables to balance their position. Now, you will have to continue to subsidize them through that, because it's going to be expensive for them. But that's how you continue to make the energy-only market relevant to the end user price. Because what you're seeing now in Germany is that the energy component of the bill is shrinking, as Tom said, and the tax component is growing. While in the UK, we have a relatively smaller tax component, but a huge energy component. That's why our bills are relatively lower.
So that's the long-term vision. There's an awful lot that needs to be done to get there. But I think improving interconnection and then the bureaucratic internal energy market moves, those are the things that we could be focusing on more.
What about Labour's policy of freezing prices for a period?
I was asking you, Henry.
It's not popular in the industry, obviously.
That bit I know.
That bit you know. I can see the merit of doing it as an attention grabber, as Tom said, and then you work hard to get the other package of proposals through, one of which could be rearranging the shape of the Big Six, which is what we've been talking about. So you do that as your insurance policy, as your attention grabber, but then you work hard to either get the self-supply restriction in place or to distance generation from supply, which will make generation more competitive. But I would say we've tried it before, and you have to have tolerance of scarcity pricing if you're going to do that. You're going to see some very big peak prices, and that's going to grab at the attention of the media, of politicians. Politicians are going to get really worried about that. We've seen it before where PowerGen said the sector is bust. British Energy had to be bailed out by the government. Mm-hmm. And then they were allowed to reintegrate as a result.
Okay. John?
I think Henry's right about renewables to be balanced responsible. But one of the other factors we've got to take into account is who's paying for the interconnection. And those interconnection costs are going up because of the greater need for connectivity with intermittent generation, and it's often not cited where the consumers are. Just that's a reality. On the freezing of prices, I don't think we should assume that it's not popular with the industry simply because obviously they'd like to be able to charge high prices. I think there's another factor, and that is that what does it portend about the general approach to the market framework for the future? And that political uncertainty, I think, is weighing on the risk perception of investors, and it's obviously got a feedback into the cost of capital.
People are holding back until they see how the land lies.
They're holding back until they see how the land lies, and also there might be a hangover effect as people kind of worry about what future changes may be brought in for attention grabbing or whatever way you want to describe it, even if underneath that there are a series of other well worked through reforms.
Tom, if you'd been in power when Mr. Miliband made his speech to the Labour conference of not this year, the year before, and you froze prices the day after that speech because you were in government, that would have been a mistake, wouldn't it? Because wholesale prices have actually fallen. You wouldn't want to freeze them. You'd want to take benefit of fallen prices.
It's a cap on price increases. And that's how it was expressed at the time and how it's always been. So it doesn't stop you charging a lower price. It stops you increasing your price above the reference point.
But doesn't it deter energy companies from cutting their prices in case you then come in and cap them at the lower price?
Well, it's interesting because this is something which I think the government sort of started to toy with saying. Amber Rudd made a speech at Energy UK conference when she suggested, I think there were two of the Big Six had said to her, and we could probably guess who the two are, that you know, they would have cut their prices were it not for the price freeze proposal, which tells you two things. Firstly, that if those companies are doing that at the time at which they've got the Competition and Markets Authority crawling all over you to get the evidence for their inquiry, then you're pretty reckless about your business.
That sounded like a propaganda line from the companies to me.
Yes. And you know, the other thing is that, you know, if that is what's happening, then that is becomes evidence of the type of issues which the state of the market assessment that Ofgem produced, which led to the CMA reference
in the first place,
pointed out in the first place. Can I just come to this, this point just briefly about interconnection? Because I think this is really important about, you know, the potential for increase in interconnection over the next period is, you know, we should have a doubled capacity by 2020. The issue that I struggle with to understand is why interconnection is not eligible for the capacity market. Because if the capacity market is about, supposedly, intellectually and conceptually, about trying to be able to address the peaks and troughs in demand through a mechanism, then why you know, interconnection isn't within that is something which I struggle with. And I suspect that it may well be something that after we've had the results of the first auctions, which are, I think, 2 weeks' time, or whatever, at the start of January, so the early part of next year, but that's something that I suspect the government may well look at again.
Henry?
Yeah, absolutely. And to my knowledge, they will do that. They've said that once it's up and running, they want to bring in third parties, they want to bring in the interconnectors, they want to bring in other European actors. It's just a matter of getting the things built so that it's a significant number in the game, because at the moment it's not a significant number in the game.
Well, it's the French, the Dutch.
Yeah, but the French link is 2 gigawatts. The BritNed is, I don't know, another 800 or 1,000 megawatts. In the scheme of things, when you're looking to find 48 gigawatts it's in this marginal. First auction, it's marginal. So the more we can add, the better.
Just before I get some final questions from the floor, on this issue of switching, because the greatest discipline in any company is my ability to move my business from it to your competitor or competitors. And there's been a lot of talk about the need to improve switching since in the aftermath of Mr. Miliband's speech too, which put energy right on the agenda. But the figures show that switching is actually in decline.
Yeah.
And having tried to do it myself, I'm not surprised. I mean, I have attempted to move from British Gas to Ofwat. It took 6 months to get out and complete the paperwork for British Gas, and another 6 months to get into Ofwat. Why would you bother?
Yeah, absolutely, and that's part of the... I mean, I think when Charles Hendry was Energy Minister, which I know was 4 Energy Ministers ago, but I think he famously admitted that he tried to do it and he gave up because it was too complicated. I've done
it. Well, I would have given up if I hadn't had someone to help me.
Yeah, and the point I referenced in my opening remarks about the number of people that just never have, and they disproportionately, those people will be on the worst tariff. They won't be on, you know, the different offers because they're not engaged in that market, partly because it's complicated, as you said, partly because I think people view it as a utility and they sort of almost feel as though it's something where, you know, they should be getting a fair deal without doing anything. And it's, you know, it's a big issue because the switching, you're right, the switching rates are down. There was a spike last autumn and I think they've gone up in the last couple of months a bit again.
Right.
But overall, it's gone down. And, you know, so all of the things that they're trying to do through the regulator to make switching more straightforward and more simple, which you get in other markets now, and the pressure on with banks and mobile phones and everything else, is exactly what should happen so people can properly engage in the market.
We could have a competition to see what's easier, moving your gas account or moving your bank account.
Yeah.
Both are a nightmare trying to... Final questions from the floor to our panel? Yes. Yes, sir.
Mr. Breivik's, when Mr. Miliband made his price-free speech and demonised the power companies, in effect, this is on an industry that we heard earlier appears to be making 4% of the bill its profit. When you buy a packet of crisps from the newsagent, he makes 20% on that. So you unleashed, or Mr. Miliband unleashed, a politicisation of the UK energy market. And the most common theme that's come out of this conference has been a number of people from across the spectrum who say that the investment environment is totally uncertain now. Aren't you responsible for that?
Sounds like the kind of question I would ask you, Tom.
Yes, I'm surprised you didn't. Short answer is no. Take your three elements of your, in a bit more detail, the politicisation and demonisation of a sector. The speech that Ed Miliband made a year and a bit ago was not the start of there being issues with the energy market and the energy companies, and particularly the big six suppliers. If you look back all the time I've been in Parliament, which is 4 and a bit years, there have been issues around aspects of that, and it built up and built up because of some of the factors I talked about in terms of people paying more attention to it, probably because they were feeling it more, but issues that were there over the medium term that needs to be dealt with. So that demonisation or that lack of trust, crisis of confidence, whichever way you want to put it. I mean, I think it was the year before Ed Miliband's speech on the price freeze that SSE first talking about the trust agenda. It was almost exactly a year before. It was Ian March, and I just remember that because it was the first week I was doing this job, so it was October 2011. So Now, they wouldn't have done that if they didn't think there was an issue to try to address. So I think that actually the realities of people's, the public's relationship with their energy suppliers predates that speech. Secondly, on the 4% figure. Now, if you want to talk about the percentage that the retailer makes on the retail part of the business, then and over an average, that may well be about right. SSE have said, and they publicly say they want to get 5%, and different times there have been, you know, margins between 2 and 5%. So 4% may well be right. But what that ignores or doesn't take account of is the level of profit in the generation part of the business overall, the overall portfolio, particularly with some of those because of the different mixes that all of the big generators have, and the relationship between the generated part of the power and how they sell it to onto their retail arms and how that gets, how that then goes on to the customer. So in some instances there have been profit margins of up to 25% in parts of the generation business. So, which is exactly the argument for the transparency that we talked about earlier on, to make sure that that is clear. So whether or not there's been any abuse, the opportunity for there to be abuse is removed, and I think that's important for the confidence in the market. And on that point about investment and the investment environment, look, a price freeze for a fixed, specific, defined period, or a price cap, technically, or for that fixed, specific, defined period of 20 months, is very different from the big issues that are affecting investment when I talk to investors, and including internationally. Actually, it's more about the mixed messages they get from within the government, sometimes even from within the same department of the government. A process of introducing new mechanisms through the Energy Act, which are just starting to take effect, and we referenced the point about the capacity market mechanisms. And last week, I think it was last week, maybe the week before, RBS, Andrew Buglis from RBS, who is one of the biggest investors in low carbon technologies, was asked about this at the Select Committee hearings, and made clear that his experience from talking to the investors that he partners with in his investments, it's not so much that specific period for that price freeze that's causing concern, it's political uncertainty that comes from a number of different aspects of this wider debate, which I think is there and was there anyway and needs to be addressed. That's why we need the reform in the market, to make sure it's clear and transparent, so people know and can have confidence in what they're going to make investment decisions in.
Okay, another question from the floor? Yes, right at the very back.
Thank you. James Trafford from Evershed. Just to pick up on the previous question, I don't think it's so much a question of what the percentage profit is. The reality is that the energy companies are not investing. And whatever margin they feel is necessary in order to invest in not just renewables, but the CCGT power plants we talked about earlier, Centrica with a massive loss there, it isn't happening. And it isn't an overly political question of whether that's the effect of the Labour policy on a cap or the CMA. The result is the investments are not being made. And I totally agree with you that part of that is down to policy uncertainty. But the overall arena of investment is not where it needs to be in this country.
Right, let's finish up on that, on the investment issue, because throughout today we've heard about the geopolitical impact on the energy business and the various supply and demand constraints. We've also seen uncertainty now in the subsidy framework for renewables. We've seen how gas stations have been closed down and the government's now trying to unmothball them in case there's a supply constraint, and we've seen hydrocarbon prices now start to fall. First gas, now oil, is falling. In that, and yet we've also seen today this demand is part of a decarbonizing of the whole energy system. Demand for massive investment across from nuclear power to more renewables. Is that investment going to happen, Henry?
Well, let's have a look at the main instrument that's meant to bring it forward, which is the capacity mechanism. So I'll just look at that very quickly. It's a clearing price auction. Everybody gets the same price. Now, the problem, potential problem that people are talking about is that that will actually just extend the life of existing coal plant, of existing gas plant, and actually reduce the amount of new plant coming online. It's an unintended consequence that could, as Peter said last week, hit the UK with a bow wave of closures in the 2020s when the carbon limitations really kick in, and we just have to say, on a pure regulatory front, you have to close now.
Interesting. John?
I agree with that, and Henry's expressed what I call the gas conundrum very much more clearly. I think it would happen if we can get people to have confidence that the framework is stable, that it's reasonably predictable, which does not mean that it's not going to change in response to changing circumstances, but there needs to be an understanding of what kind of circumstances are going to act as trigger points, when they're going to be when they're going to be activated, really. And I think it's that confidence in the overall predictability and logic of the way in which the framework is constructed and administered over the next 3, 5, 10 years that is going to determine whether the investment comes forward.
Thank you. Tom, you get the final word at the Spectator Energy Forum.
Thank you very much. In broad terms, it's important to note that Labour supported the energy, what is now the Energy Act, and those two key mechanisms in terms of contracts for difference in the capacity market. That doesn't mean that every aspect of it so far has been handled correctly. I've had some points to make around the way in which the FID enabling process was done. You know, it seemed to bring some arbitrariness back to something which was supposed to remove it. There are still concerns around the value in terms of the Hinkley deal, and in terms of the capacity market, I've just touched on one or two, but there are a number of different issues around that which mean that it would be appropriate, I think, for whoever is in government ahead of the second round of the capacity market to properly assess the experience of the first round, and that is appropriate to give. So that doesn't give you absolute certainty in terms of this investment decision, but it should help to give clarity in terms of direction. And then, you know, experience is a wonderful thing for being able to ensure that your policy is better based, and that's what we need to be able to be flexible enough to adapt to without chopping everything up and starting again. Because the worst thing I think, and I hear from investors when I talk to them, is that if you just chopped everything up, started all over again, we'd be in the same position we've been for the last 2 or 3 years, where because things are going through, people have been waiting to see what's going to happen. We've got to end that period of people waiting to see what's going to happen too if we're going to achieve that investment. And it's not just about the environment, is also about security of supply, and these things aren't mutually exclusive.
All right, Tom, thank you for that. I said we finish on time. This is exactly 5:15, and that's when we were scheduled to finish. I think there are some forms on the seats if you wish to fill them in, what you think of today, how we can improve it, make it better. Those who say the chairing was superb can put their drinks on my tab at the end. We will publish everything we've heard today, the speeches and points that have been made, will all be on the Spectator's website. There'll be a digital vertical site there, which will aggregate everything we've heard. Oxford Analytica's report will be on there as well, and there'll be room for comments, and we get a bit of a debate going. And it will form the basis for how we plan next year's conferences on energy as well. All there is for me to do is to thank Evershed again for making this wonderful facility available to us, for Liberum and Eastern Airways for being the essential sponsors, and also for Thorbald Fueling for sponsoring the drinks we're about to have. Before you go, a round of applause for our final panel.
Yes.